Jamie Miller.
Larry, first, I just want to say I also, like Mike, appreciate your comments today, and especially the continued focus on due process and appropriate time to issue quality standards by the board, and just the thoughtful consideration of the issues that you've exhibited over the last several months. Again, reiterating, Mike, the reprioritization that's been undertaken by the FASB and the IASB, I think, has been very helpful to the process. But we discussed last year some of the challenges that will be faced by preparers in digesting the proposed changes, and the same issues will be present for auditors, and I think in some cases they'll be more exacerbated for auditors. You know, preparers will likely have 2 to 3 years of kind of working with data and working with the standards and determining how they should be adopted at the data and transaction level, and I think auditors may be challenged simply because they'll have a more compressed time frame to really audit, challenge, and evaluate that information. And I think it just says that as you consider the transition approach for these standards, we need to be very, very thoughtful about how we do that. And, you know, it goes without saying that understanding investors' needs are very critical in evaluating those transition timeframes and what they should be. But I think it also needs to be balanced by potentially the impacts on other parties. And so when I think about things like a 3-year retrospective, which is, you know, one of the methods being proposed, and compare that with, say, a 1-year retrospective or a prospective adoption approach, you know, a 3-year retrospective could put auditors in a situation where there's potentially a lot of information to audit in a very compressed time frame. I also think some of the other challenges, and this gets to maybe some of Barbara's comments as well, are that it's hard for auditors to really separate use of hindsight versus what judgments companies would have made at the time when establishing financial statement amounts for things like impairments or revenue recognition in long-term contracts. And so while I think that's a challenge for both preparers and auditors, it's certainly very, very complicated, and it's hard if you have a 3-year retrospective implementation. You know, whereas the 1-year retrospective or a prospective, again, just might be more manageable and being more real-time, sort of a focused level of volume and something that people can digest more easily. So it's, to me, it's just an area that requires just continued thoughtful consideration, and I'd be curious as to your comments or thoughts on the time frame for when the FASB would begin publishing or discussing its preliminary thoughts and decisions. I know that was recently deliberated, but, you know, maybe give us a sense as to where you are in the process and what the timing is.
I think we totally appreciate the challenges with respect to retrospective, 3-year retrospective transition method. At the same time, the user community, particularly as it relates to revenue recognition, you know, feels very strongly that some comparative data is necessary. The real issue and question before us is whether 3 years is necessary, 2 years is necessary, 1 year is necessary, or whether we do something similar to some other EITF issues that we've dealt with recently, where we say, okay, if you can't go back in time, maybe you can go forward in time under the old method and show us the differences. So all of those considerations will be on the table when we get to that point. You know, to be perfectly honest, we are so much in the throes of just deliberating the fundamental issues associated with the projects that I think it's a little bit early for us. And those decisions might in turn influence the extent to which people may be able to go back or not. So I think it's a little premature for us for me to commit specifically as to when we're going to debate that. You know, if we hit our timetable, you know, I mean, theoretically, we should be debating it, you know, early May at the latest. But so that remains to be seen. But Jamie, you know, I think we're totally aware of the challenges to a retrospective adoption. So we'll be looking at everything possible to A, reduce the cost and frustration of dealing with transition, but B, comply with the informational requirements of users.
Okay, thanks. And Jamie, some of those issues you raised we'll be talking about in the SAG discussion topics shortly. Damon Silvers?
Barry, I have two questions for you. One is, and I don't think you've been here for these discussions, but I have noted frequently at this in this meeting, in this body, that in my other capacity on the Congressional Oversight Panel for TARP, we endeavored to try to identify more than a year ago TARP stand of course stands for Troubled Asset Relief Program. We attempted to identify the extent and value of troubled assets on the balance sheets of publicly traded financial institutions using GAAP financials as our primary method, and found that it could not be done. That conclusion is in the panel's August 2009 oversight report. It certainly limited our capacity to do oversight. The fact that we couldn't identify, that is in charge with the oversight of troubled assets, we couldn't identify how many there were at public companies. Of course, we had a budget from Congress and a staff of 30 people who basically were only focused on this question and still could not answer it. I'm curious about what, if any, conclusions FASB draws from that set of circumstances about the current state of the GAAP framework. And then secondly, I noted your comment about contingent liabilities, that the board was perhaps rethinking that initiative. there's a whole lot of big important issues about contingent liabilities out there right now. And I'm curious, does the board view, or did the board before the meeting you referred to think of contingent think that there was a single framework for contingent liabilities? I believe that was the import of the release that you took up. And do you now have a different view, or what exactly is the board's or your current view? I know you may not be able to speak for the board. What exactly is your current view of the question of, is there a single framework for contingent liabilities? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about what that is.
Okay, so since it's fresher on my mind, I'll respond to the second question first.
That's fine.
We have not changed our mind with respect to disclosure of contingencies. What we've done is we've put it on hold to evaluate whether some of the actions by the SEC in terms of their Dear CFO type letters has resulted in a change, a perceived change in how contingencies are being disclosed, what's being disclosed, et cetera, to enable us to decide whether we think there is an issue that needs to be addressed or whether there is not. The difficulty that we've had in dealing with disclosures of contingencies in general has been basically lawyers' reluctance to disclose certain things that they believe will hurt their case. And it is an understandable position on the part of lawyers, and there are specific requirements right now in FAS 5 regarding contingencies, and we want to see whether those disclosures have improved, and then make a determination as to whether they should be improved further, and if so, to what degree. So we have not made any decisions specifically one way or another. We're in a holding pattern, you know, waiting to see what happens.
Is it? Do I understand it rightly from your answer that your view, and perhaps the board's view, is that there is a single conceptual framework for dealing with when a contingent liability needs to be disclosed and the scale of that liability, and that it's embodied in FAS 5 currently, and that you're anticipating perhaps adjusting that, but you think there is such a thing as a single conceptual framework for this issue?
Okay. Well, I wouldn't use the term conceptual framework, but
use a term you'd like.
I believe there is a specific requirement as to what should be disclosed in the financial statements for contingencies, and really the purpose of our project on contingencies was to address issues regarding the implementation of the requirements under FAS 5.
So your view continues to be that there should be one set of principles governing all contingencies.
That is not my position. Okay, that the decision we made related to that project was to relate it to FAS 5 contingencies. Okay, it was not a reconsideration of contingency disclosures in general, and we have not addressed that whatsoever. We've done no staff research to enable me to respond to your question.
I mean, I think it's extremely important in terms of the credibility of FASB generally that there be some consistency on this point. That there not be one set of rules for politically connected contingencies and another set of rules for non-politically connected contingencies. And I'd appreciate it if you answered my other question.
Okay. What was your question again? It was what have we done to address the fact that there were TARP assets that you could not find or could not value?
I find it surprising that you couldn't follow me, but let me try it again.
I'm sorry, Damon. You know, I'm sitting here trying to respond to your question.
No, I understand. It's just that this question has preoccupied the entire country for 4 years, and I'm not sure why it's so hard for you to follow, but let me try it again. So there are these things called troubled assets. Perhaps you've heard of them. They are not TARP assets. They are the troubled assets on the balance sheets of TARP recipient institutions. Many of them have something to do with home mortgages. The firms involved are firms that file GAAP accounting statements. When our oversight panel, with its staff of 30 people, solely devoted to this question, tried to determine, using GAAP financial statements, what troubled assets were on the balance sheets of publicly traded firms, and this was again in the summer of 2009, our staff could not answer the question. We could not answer the question of how many such troubled assets were there. And after all, we're talking about a body impaneled under something called the Troubled Asset Relief Program established by the Congress of the United States. We couldn't answer the question. Now, my question to you is, what does FASB conclude from the fact that you can't answer that question under GAAP?
Okay, we have specific disclosure requirements with respect to marketable securities, et cetera, which compares both fair value to cost basis and also the extent to which there's delinquencies. So we have some specific disclosures. Now, as to the identification of what you're considering to be troubled assets, we have not put on a project specifically to try to define those.
Let me put it a different way. Is it that our staff is incompetent? Is it that Congress?
I don't know specifically what you were doing, okay, in terms of identifying them and what your objectives were. So I can't respond to that question. I can't.
Right. Okay, in the interest of time, I think we need to move on. The question's been asked and answered.
I'd like to remind him that I was acting on behalf of the Congress of the United States to determine what had happened and whether the objectives of the $700 billion TARP program had been achieved. And that ought to be of some concern, the fact that we could not use the statements prepared under your rules to answer those questions ought to be of some concern to the FASB.
Larry, thanks. Joe Carcella.
Larry, one comment and one question. I apologize for my voice. I think it's the springtime analogies are so great. In response to one of Damon's questions on the contingency issue, and you indicated that you're in somewhat of a wait-and-see mode to see how effective the SEC's dear CFO letters are. And here's the comment. I would suggest for you to consider the fact that you're largely dependent on, when a CFO gets that letter, presumably came from the chief accountant, it's going to get their attention. And not all chief accountants are going to focus on that issue with equal vigilance. And so 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now, when there's a new chief accountant or priorities have changed, it's very possible that behavior reverts to what it was before the dear CFO letters. So I don't know if that's a substitute for standards, I guess is my point, for you to at least consider. The question, as I heard you talk about consolidation, in the U.S., under FASB standards, we're using a majority vote rule. And under IFRS or IASB standards, we're using effective control. That strikes me, and maybe you can illuminate this for me, Larry, as a really big difference, or potentially a really big difference. And so my sense would be under IFRS, we'll see a lot more consolidations, whereas comparable companies in the U.S., would presumably be accounting for a similar type sub using the equity method, which will give you very, very different, as you know even better than I, income statements and balance sheets. And so I guess my question would be, A, am I wrong? And if I'm not wrong, to what extent, if any, will note disclosures be able to enable analysts and other users to essentially reconstruct the alternative hypothesis, if you will?
You're not wrong theoretically. Okay, as I understand it, anecdotally, there are many IFRS reporting entities or countries where they might actually, even though they currently have the effect, because right now they have the effective control rule as well, that many times they look to U.S. GAAP for guidance in terms of how to evaluate that. That being the case, I understand, and I believe it's particularly in France, that there are companies that are consolidating other companies when they do not have voting control, when they have effective control, so let's say 45% or something like that. So in those instances, you are going to have differences in reporting, and I'm not totally familiar with their disclosure requirements in terms of, you know, specifically if they have to say whether they have less than a majority, so I apologize. But I think I don't think the difference is quite, from a practical standpoint, is quite as great as you believe it is, just because of the way people are applying IFRS right now. And this is what I'm being told anecdotally from talking to the staff, primarily from the staff of the IASB.
Larry, I just want to interject for a second on the point that Joe Carcello was making and actually came up earlier as well. I think it's a very important issue, the matter of contingencies and obvious loss contingencies, and obviously the board does too by your efforts to put out some exposure drafts in that area. And I think the point Joe was making, that the Dear CFO letters will certainly highlight a particular area where maybe disclosures will be improved in that area because of the SEC being on top of that issue and sending out those kind of letters. But I think the question continues to exist, and if I understand it correctly, I think the board has kind of asked the SEC through CorpFin and maybe PCOB through our inspections, is the problem with loss contingency disclosures, especially around those that aren't probable but reasonably possible, is this really an accounting standards problem, or is it a compliance and enforcement issue? And are the existing standards workable, but there's just companies are not eager to lay out reasonably possible losses to the, and if they think that they can avoid that. And so, therefore, is there a compliance and enforcement issue there? Is that a question that I think the board's kind of asked us to think about, both CorpFin and PCAOB?
Definitely. I mean, there are when we've struggled with the issue in terms of coming up with a proposed standard, you know, we've asked ourselves and you know, we've talked about it amongst the PCAOB and the SEC as to whether this is a compliance issue or whether it's a standards issue. And that's why we're looking forward to seeing the results of the Dear CFO letter.
Galen Hansen.
Larry, like others, I'd like to express thanks for being willing to come and run the gauntlet here with us this morning. I mean, I would like to change maybe the direction of some of what I was talking to you about a little bit earlier this morning, and that is whether or not the constituency that you've got feedback on this process, and I look at this is the timing and you know, where are we going with this in the short term? And in looking through the comment letters that came back to the FASB, we just really didn't see a lot from the smaller companies. We didn't see virtually anything from smaller firms out of the 120 comment letters. And I guess I'm real concerned about that we're operating in somewhat of a vacuum. And I'm not sure why that was. I don't know if you know, I know that people have high demands on their times. They have the resources and ability to respond to such complex matters in a short period of time. I don't know if that word got out there sufficiently well enough, but hopefully you're going to get some additional feedback on that. You know, in particular, Arnie raised the question about resources. The big four firms have the ability to address some of these things. That, you know, how does that happen with small and medium-sized firms or preparers for that matter? And that time frame that Jamie Miller was talking about, that compressed time frame, you know, the larger firms are out at the big companies virtually all year round. For the smaller businesses, that is even more compressed, where they're out there during a period of a month or two or even weeks on some occasions. So I would get real concerned with that. The other thing is I'm not sure that the complexity on these standards are the same for all preparers, and I'm talking in very broad terms. The smaller companies, some of these are actually, I think, in some sense, more complex for the smaller companies than they are larger ones. By that I mean the smaller companies that are doing complex equity transactions with embedded derivatives, unconvertible debt or debentures, preferred stock issues that larger companies are not having to deal with on a regular basis. So, you know, I'm in terms of the feedback and in terms of the issues that you're dealing with, I think you're only getting a partial view. So, and then we have this whole initiative on looking at private GAAP. Where does that fit in to this? I'm glad to see, especially on the derivatives issue, that we're going to give that a little bit longer. What, a four-year delay on the private side to deal with some of these things? Or there's a timing differential somewhere in here for some of that. But I'd be interested to hear what your comments might be on that.
Yeah, we recognize the fact that we did not receive much formal feedback in terms of letters from smaller companies. And we have a separate outreach endeavor to try to appropriately evaluate the challenges and the timing for smaller companies. So we will be reaching out to the smaller companies and using some of our resource committees to appropriately evaluate that. In terms of You mentioned derivatives, but I think you meant classification and measurement. That's where we provided smaller companies with a four-year window to implement the standard. I would venture to say that some of the decisions we've made in terms of classification and measurement in redeliberations might influence our decision or the length of time over which we might consider delaying implementation for smaller entities for that particular standard. The concerns specifically for those smaller institutions with respect to the exposure draft was that we were requiring fair value of loans on the balance sheet. And we thought that smaller companies needed more time to get their systems in place and to educate themselves as to what they needed to do, as well as to watch what the larger companies were doing. We've since changed our model in redeliberation such that the expectation, at least from my standpoint, would be that many more loans would be recorded at amortized cost as opposed to fair value, and therefore the implementation difficulties that existed with the exposure draft should not be as great for the if we finalize the decisions we've made to date. So that will influence our thinking on that. But that being said, you know, at least within the last couple of years, we've tended with respect to private companies to give them an extra delay. And one of the primary concerns with private companies is that their primary education system revolves around educating during the summer. So effectively, we need to consider their educational cycle with respect to implementation dates. You know, there's been no significant change in that, so I think we would continue to evaluate that. The real question is it the private-public split that's the appropriate split in terms of delaying implementation, or should there be a large public, small public split? That is a very tough issue from our standpoint. You know, there's one school of thought that says smaller companies do not have the resources of larger companies, so therefore they need more time. There's another school of thought that says if you're a public company, you're a public company, and therefore you ought to be have the same timing requirements. And those are things that we need to consider.
In the interest of time, we have 5 tent cards up. We'll take those remaining questions, and then we'll break for lunch. Next, Nary Books fan.
Thank you. An observation and a question. I'll start with the question because it's probably simpler. We will be discussing disclosure framework, and some discussion on disclosure were made earlier. It would be useful to actually give us some insights of, notwithstanding timing, what the board plans to take up in this project and what's expected to play out, because I think it's going to incite our discussion in the afternoon. The second observation is more broad. It goes to some comments I made in this forum probably a year ago, which is very consistent with some of the elements we discussed today. For me as a user, what I think about financial statements, it serves two purposes. One is needs to provide useful information with utility to the users, being them whoever they are. And two, there has to be some notion of reliability to it, which is the element of what this board is doing. I think sometimes those elements are intertwined. Because of reliability issues, you have some issues of relevance. But I think the session that Bob Hertz has in his last in his speech to the AAA conference, he was asked whether it was a single project that he regrets from not taking up earlier. And the topic that he mentioned was conceptual framework. Interestingly enough, I'm sitting on both the advisory board for the International Accounting Standard Board and the FASB. Both of those advisory boards have been very consistent now in yearning for the very same thing. And what I'm hearing here this morning is very similar desires from people here with respect to what disclosures should tell the users, what should disclosure even be consistent for contingencies and something else. And my observation is more an observation of priority, and I recognize what your agenda is now and what you need to do by June 30th. But what I think is incumbent on perhaps all of us and other participants to think what we're doing after June 30th, because those, in my mind, are quite serious and significant issues, even if you just replay the tape from the last 30 minutes. I would also suggest, and again, I've raised two anecdotal observations. One is the liabilities and equity, and one is leases. For example, the topic of leases was not mentioned in your discussion, and now the boards are rethinking introducing some notions such as operating lease. The notion of consolidation discussed 49% or 50%. I would venture to say that those issues are not new. They have nothing to do with financial crisis. Leases have always been there, and people are struggling and grappling with the very same issues. Which gets me to, again, a very simple observation. The reason that I think some of those issues are not being resolved is not because there's no one right answer, because there are more than one right answer. And some of the comments you're going to get, whether it's 60-40 or 50-60 or 70-30, are associated with comments that people are raising very good issues. The problem that we have is the difficulties to reconcile it to a mothership, to a concept, to something we are always familiar with. If you don't have it, whether you have it for auditing or accounting, you are in an environment that everybody is right, and it's very difficult to resolve the issues, which gets me to the issue of priorities. And I would venture to say that, you know, perhaps leasing or consolidation should not be priority, but rather conceptual framework would. I'd like to get your observation on both.
I listen with interest about what you said about the conceptual framework, and I've listened to the discussion at the last FASAC meeting that we had where a number of people expressed the same views. And I guess I have a little different view, and these clearly are my views. People talk as if we don't have a conceptual framework. That is not true. Okay, we definitely have a conceptual framework. And if you saw some of the amendments that we've worked on, that the two boards have agreed on in terms of definitions of assets and liabilities, et cetera, the changes aren't all that earth-shattering, which is, I think, one of the reasons why the boards have said, let's put this, you know, some of these discussions on the back burner. That being said, there are parts of our conceptual framework that are in need of something. We don't have anything. Probably the primary one that comes to mind is the measurement basis. You know, what is an appropriate measurement basis? What should we look to guide people to assess whether a cost is more appropriate in one circumstance versus a fair value in another circumstance? And while we don't have a conceptual framework with respect to measurement basis right now, although we are working on it, we do have other aspects of our conceptual framework that the board members can look to. You know, the qualitative characteristic of financial statements and and how you assess those are directly related to the conceptual framework that I think we would develop with respect to the measurement basis. So, you know, I guess, Neri, my reaction to what you said is I don't think having taking our conceptual framework and evolving it to a higher state, to a more improved state, will necessarily provide us with the answers to the leasing questions that we have right now. I think we'll still have differences of opinion among people, even if you apply a more robust conceptual framework with respect to those issues. I'm not saying that we should not strive. I think we need to, particularly when it relates to the measurement basis, we need to establish that. And we need some type of a framework for disclosure. The project that we have right now is a very broad project on disclosure framework and what we should have in it. As you know, I mean, ITAC came up with a proposal a couple of years ago as to what things should be a minimum And some of those things are being considered with respect to the conceptual framework project that we are, I'm sorry, the disclosure framework project that we have. Additionally, as a part of that project, we'll be looking at the existing disclosures that we have and whether there are disclosure-specific requirements or general requirements that should be removed in light of the fact that we've now agreed to add X, Y, and Z, whatever we agree to. So our disclosure framework project is a very broad project. Whether it becomes a standard or a framework is still a question in my mind. Right now it's being proposed as a standard project. I'm having difficulty understanding why it's a standard project as opposed to a conceptual framework project, but that I don't think that's that important.
I can do it here and expand, but there's given it a five other cards. I don't want to take more than my allotted time, so we can do it offline, but I do think it's a conceptual framework issue. I'll elaborate it separately.
Thanks. If Sam Ranzilla?
Larry, I don't have a question. just an observation first. Let me just say from this member of the SAG that I am very supportive of the work that you've been doing and your board and the way you're going about your due process through the convergence process. So, but here's the observation. As you look to the retrospective versus prospective, maybe limited retrospective, I think it's important to coordinate very closely with the SEC around the retrospective treatment. Jamie made reference to a three-year retrospective. Because of the five-year table under selected financial data, there's at least some views that have been expressed that a retrospective application of a standard is a five-year retrospective. That is, again, speaking just for myself, the cost of going back into fourth and fifth years simply doesn't seem to warrant any benefit. And, in fact, maybe I'll take this opportunity to ask the SEC, not for this forum, but should we reconsider whether or not the five-year table has actually outlived its usefulness to begin with. To the extent that it hasn't, it sure seems to me that on a retrospective application, going back 5 years is excessive. So I'm not looking for – that's not a question, but just an observation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. Doug Carmichael?
Concerned with the auditability of revenue recognition. There are some business arrangements and some industries that are very susceptible to earnings management, revenue misstatement. And I wonder what kind of, an outstanding example would be software vendors, where the criteria for revenue recognition have been developed in response to abuses in the past. What kind of discussions have you had about the implications of making that guidance more subjective, fewer kinds of tests than an auditor can readily apply for the quality of audited financial statements and the credibility of the process?
I believe the subjectivity or auditability of revenue has been at the forefront of many board members' minds through the discussions. As I alluded to earlier, yesterday we spent 4 hours discussing variable contingent arrangements in connection with revenue transactions and how they should be accounted for. And there are differences of views, but I think there are a number of board members who would like to see a specific hurdle that would have to be met or surpassed in order to allow somebody to recognize revenue. There are other board members that don't share that view, that believe that you know, you should be able to make an estimate and live by that estimate, and then make changes as you obtain information to cause you to believe that that estimate should be changed. But so that was part of the difficulty we were dealing with yesterday. Specifically as it relates to software, I guess there's different feedback that we receive. Some of the feedback is that the rules that were written for software were written probably when the software industry was kind of at its early phases, and therefore there was a great need for that type of robust, specific guidance. I think as time has evolved, people are feeling more comfortable with people's ability to evaluate software revenue recognition methodologies, such that a specific environment or requirement like 97.2 is no longer necessary. And clearly, I think through the feedback we've received on our exposure draft, people are feeling that while there might be certain circumstances where things are more difficult to estimate, I think people are feeling comfortable or more comfortable that you'd be able to apply the provisions within our revised set of decisions that we've made in redeliberation. So, you know, I think we've put enough in terms of what people should be looking at to come up with how a transaction price ought to be allocated to the various components to enable people to apply it without something like 97.2.
Chef Mahoney.
Thank you. Larry, a couple things. One, there were several comments on retrospective application. And I think you've received some input indicating that maybe one way to reduce the cost is to push ahead the effective date, so that would encompass some one or more of the retrospective years. So I'd encourage the board to consider that as an alternative. The second item, I wanted to get your thoughts on this notion of a big bang, and what in your view that encompasses. Your list of joint projects shows 10 projects, and then you have a number of FASB-only projects. So I assume not all 10 of those could be part of a big bang, since some of them, earliest they could be done would be 2013 per your website. So those wouldn't be part of a big bang. So I assume the big bang's smaller than that. But then there are these other very major projects that are outside of the big bang. So does that mean there would be like a second big bang following the first big bang? I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that. Thank you.
Well, and then there is also a decision that the SEC might give some indication as to where we're headed in terms of IFRS as a whole. So that's another thing to throw into the equation. Obviously, we just have to talk to more people and come up with different alternatives. I think there are a number of arguments that a big bang would be almost impossible to implement in the U.S. because there wouldn't be enough people in order to provide the expertise and spread it amongst the various companies that would have to implement the various standards, to the extent that there's, you know, particular software or consulting needs of organizations. So we have not yet held any roundtables to discuss the effective dates and the transition methods, and clearly they'll be a part of those discussions. But, you know, as to my specific reaction, you know, I don't think it really matters. I think we still have to go through the process more.
And Arnie Hainish has the last question, then we'll all wrap up and we'll break for lunch.
I will try to keep it brief then. One observation and really more clarification on a second point. From a retrospective approach, again, maybe just to build upon some of the comments, from a preparer's perspective, anything we can do to avoid, in my view, a retrospective approach would be positive. I think if I look at the briefing paper on page 7, you know, where you talk about revenue recognition being one that would be a retrospective approach. I just fathom the challenges, extreme challenges, both from an auditing standpoint as well as just a company's standpoint, to go back 3 years or maybe 5 years if it's required with regard to the supplemental information, to go back and with millions of transactions from a revenue recognition perspective across 100 different affiliates in multiple countries where you don't really have the systems in place to deal with these issues, the complexities would be extremely excruciating. And so I guess using that one as an example, I would certainly suggest that there would be some reconsideration there and try to avoid retrospective application where at all possible. I think the other one, Larry, is more of a clarification. You made the comment, at least if I wrote it correctly, that loss contingencies was put on the back burner, and then there was some dialogue sort of in the end here between you and Marty around maybe a mandate that PCOB has to look at some issues around loss contingencies as part of their inspections. I mean, my perspective is that we really need to give the SEC time to work out their reviews of financial statements and have the dialogue with individual companies that they think are not providing appropriate disclosures around loss contingencies and to let them deal with it with the registrants as opposed to having the FASB bring this issue back on the front burner. So I hope it stays on the back burner. I think that this is a extremely contentious issue relative to both with lawyers as well as the preparers and may not be in the best interest of the investors. The complexities around loss contingencies and the dynamics that evolve as you're going through a negotiation or even trying to determine whether you're going to have a settlement strategy or whether you're going to go to court, and then to have to disclose ranges of outcomes in financial statements prematurely put all of us at a disadvantage against the plaintiff's bar, and I think is not in the best interest of our investors. And so I think it is best dealt through individual dialogue between the SEC and the registrant if the SEC believes that the current disclosures that are presented within financial statements are inappropriate. I know we spend a significant amount of time agonizing over our disclosures to make sure that they are robust enough to give the reader at least an idea as to where we stand with respect to the numerous pieces of litigation that we have along the continuum. But it's an incredible amount of time that's spent with inside counsel, outside counsel. But if the SEC has any, takes exception, then we're more than willing to engage in the dialogue. But to date, even with ours, and the significant amount of litigation that we've had over the years, the SEC has not raised any of those issues with regard to the disclosures that we've presented in the past. So.
I don't think there's a mandate for the PCOB there, but I think what we were saying before was that FASB had asked the SEC at CorpFin and us through our inspection and CorpFin through their efforts were there compliance issues with respect to disclosures on contingencies to help inform their thinking. But I appreciate your points. I think there is one more card up, and we will take that, and then we finally let Larry off the hook and we'll break for lunch. Thanks, John.
Yeah, on the contingencies point, I guess being somewhat on the front lines of it as a lawyer, it does appear that CorpFin is very actively looking at this from a compliance perspective. And, you know, CorpFin sends out about 4,000-plus comment letters every year. And they are, let me just say, actively asking these questions. And I recently looked at the 10-Ks for five of the largest financial institutions, the 2010 10-Ks, and compared them to the 2009 10-Ks. And in all five, you saw for the first time a number in there for reasonably possible losses, you know, in billions of dollars in each one of them. So the disclosures are changing. Now, whether they're getting, you know, to where FASB wants them or where the SEC wants them, I won't speak to that, but there clearly are changes occurring. out there. I mean, this is a real effort, apparently, by Brian and his colleagues, and there are some results coming out of it. I guess just one other observation. I guess I can't hold myself back on this one, but you know, if you go back to the crisis atmosphere we were in the fall of 2008, when Congress put out a bill or put out passed a law over a couple of weeks of work, and defined a new regulatory term that we'd never seen. Let me just say, it doesn't surprise me that a term that was not in GAAP. It doesn't surprise me that you can't look at GAAP financials and, you know, find the answer on troubled assets.
John, thank you for your comment. With that, I wanted to wrap up. I know on some of the in the questions through Larry, many of the discussion topics were answered. If there's things that you'd like to share with the PCOB staff on audit implications from these joint standards, you can feel free to reach out to us. But I do want to thank Larry Smith for coming, and not only Larry, but the other members of the FASB and the staff always make themselves available to join us in a forum like this, particularly when everyone at the FASB seems to be drinking from a fire hose with everything they have. So thank you, Larry, and we'll break for lunch.